The opinions and views expressed in Dead Men Do Tell Tales and all affiliated media are Jordan and Nicole's and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of their training program or others working in the field of medico-legal death investigation. Hey everyone.
Welcome to Dead Men Do Tell Tales,
a podcast about forensic pathology related topics.
I'm Nicole Kroom.
And I'm Jordan Taylor.
And we're both pathology residents who are going into forensic pathology.
And I know that two episodes ago we talked about COVID and we felt like we should probably touch on some topics that are peripherally related to COVID. And one of those is unfortunately an increase in the amount of intimate partner violence, because people are now sheltering in place and maybe they were able to escape their bad situation at home by going to work or going to friends, and that is no longer possible given the quarantines and the shelter in place that is happening.
Yeah, and in addition to having no place to escape to, there's also diminished community support because you're not supposed to be interacting in person with many people, and there's also a heightened level of distress, which are also both factors that can worsen intimate partner violence.
For sure. Bad situation all around. The kind of other side effects of the virus that many people don't think about.
Yep.
We're going to start off with some definitions. Intimate partner violence is any behavior within an intimate relationship that causes a physical, psychological, or sexual harm to those in the relationship, including acts of physical aggression, sexual coercion, psychological abuse, and controlling behaviors. Now, these can be physical, verbal, emotional, economic, sexual, and of course, in the most extreme, we think of battering, intimate terrorism, or something called coercive controlling violence, where one person is both violent and overtly controlling over the other person's life. As many know, this is usually men against women, but we do know that men are less likely to report, so the numbers might not be exactly perfect. Another aspect of this that many people don't think about is the resistance to this, which can be thought of as self-defense, but also can be called violent resistance, which can be its own form of intimate partner violence. Another type is called situational couple violence, and this is something that arises within a single argument where one or both partners lash out at one another. This is the most common form of intimate partner violence, which at some point we'll probably start calling IPV. If you hear us say IPV, that's intimate partner violence.
And less of a mouthful.
Exactly. Especially in the Western world and among young couples. And so this is not a long-term IPV situation, but this is something that comes up once and might never happen again. Might lead into something more long-term. Within college students, about 44% of this is perpetrated by women and 56% is perpetrated by men. So it is still slightly in the male predominance, but it's not as striking as in older couples. And they say that about 50% of couples experience this situational couple violence in their relationships.
Whoa.
Yeah, that's a very high amount. Which, I mean, if you think about it as like one incidence of somebody, depending on the level that you're calling into partner violence, yelling or that type of thing.
Mm.
Depends on what level. But I can see half of people at some point, somebody lashes out and they say they'll never do it again. They might never do it again.
I guess that's true.
Yeah. Another type is mutual violent control. And this is when you think of both partners acting out against each other. And they might be trying to control each other along with some of these acts of violence, et cetera, et cetera. But instead of one having a preference over another, it's kind of coming from both sides.
Huh.
Another important part of this that people don't always think of as part of IPV is stalking, which is, of course, a repeated unwanted attention and contact by a partner that causes fear or concern for one's own safety or the safety of someone close to the victim.
Yeah, when I saw that as part of the definition of the CDC website, I was definitely surprised.
Yeah, I don't think of it as part of intimate partner violence, but it is a type of psychological terrorism.
Right,
so true. It totally makes sense.
Yeah.
But yeah. And some other things that I saw listed that count as IPV, but you don't often associate with it, include selective abortion. So making somebody get an abortion.
Oh.
female genital mutilation. Again, I don't think of it as intimate partner violence, but definitely counts. Early enforced marriage, honor killings, rape, you would, trafficking, prostitution, and sexual violence in war. Just some other definitely violent in some way, in some of them, definitely violent acts, but you don't necessarily think of as IPP.
Yeah. Huh.
And one final thing I do want to say about this is that this can happen in heterosexual relationships, homosexual relationships. It can happen to men, women, whatever you consider yourself. It can happen in people that are dating, cohabitating, married. So it has a very broad definition of what an intimate partner is. And women are...
So I'm going to get a little bit into the epidemiology, although a lot of this is epidemiological, so we'll probably pepper in some other stats later on. I split my epidemiology into geographic regions, essentially. So in the United States, most of the data comes from the CDC's National Intimate Partner and Sexual Violence Survey. And intimate partner violence is, unfortunately, way too common.
Agreed.
So 1 in 4 women and 1 in 10 men have experienced some form of intimate partner violence in their lifetime. Over 43 million women and 38 million men experienced psychological aggression by an intimate partner. 11 million women and 5 million men who reported experiencing IPV in their lifetime said that they first experienced these forms of violence before the age of 18.
That's not okay.
Right. So
none of this is okay, but that's...
Yeah, it can start to happen very early. And then 1 in 6 women and 1 in 17 men have been stalked at some point in their lives.
Crazy.
So, way too common. Some statistics that are specifically... related to death, which, you know, is what we're kind of all about. Overall, about 1 in 6 homicide victims are killed by an intimate partner. And that number increases to nearly half when it's just female homicide victims.
Which is, it's one of those things that always makes me wonder, one, are females that much more affected? And two, how much more violent are those acts committed by men than women?
Yeah.
It's... scary.
Yeah.
It goes from 16% to 50%.
Yeah.
It's a huge jump.
Well,
and then if you take out like the men proportion in order to make that work for the 50%, it becomes like the number of men.
Right. No. So I have, 7.5% of men in 2016, like 7.5% of male homicide victims in 2016 were killed by an intimate partner. 7.5. Whereas female homicide victims, it was 50.1% of them were killed by an intimate partner.
And I wonder how many of those were self-defense stuff, you know? Because, like, technically, violent resistance, defending yourself,
right,
counts as intimate partner violence. But, and this is for men and women. I'm not saying just for, like, that 7.5% of male victims.
Yeah.
But I wonder how much of that is violent resistance versus the aggressor side of it. So according to the National Domestic Violence Hotline that we'll talk about later, on average, 24 people per minute are victims of rape, physical violence, or stalking by an intimate partner, which is about 12 million people per year. So yearly, 12 million people. 24 per minute. It's like one every other second.
That's unfathomable.
One every other, one every third second.
That's crazy.
Not okay.
No. Also makes me very not excited to go back out into the dating world. So this is great.
It's okay.
Yep. Or something.
If you need something, let me know.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be there.
Oh, I'll be texting you.
Under the table.
So globally, it gets worse.
No.
30% of ever partnered women globally have experienced IPV in their lifetime. And rates of violence vary between 23 and 47% in different regions of the world. And actually, many countries have no prevalence data available.
Oh.
Because this is still a field of research that's developing in many nations.
Interesting.
And so this estimate of 1 in every 3 women globally is based on WHO or World Health Organization estimates from 2010 data.
So it's
older data and it's estimates based on what they do know about certain countries. And rates of intimate partner violence tend to be higher in societies that exhibit higher levels of gender inequality and greater acceptance of norms that support violence against women and male control over women. Yes. Shocker.
I'm going to talk briefly about kind of this issue that we brought up of, are women definitely more affected than men? And the overall opinion is that, yes, women experience more IPV than men do, but there are a few groups out there who say that it is very even and men experience it just as much as women, which I found interesting. But going back to kind of the general prevailing thought is that men perpetrate IPV more than women. Women generally suffer more severe and long-lasting forms of partner abuse than men do. Men generally have more opportunities to leave an abusive partner than women do for economic reasons and that type of thing. Women suffer an overproportionate number of injuries, fear, and PTSD. 70% of female victims felt frightened as a result of violence perpetrated by their partners, whereas 85% of male victims expressed no fear.
Oh, really?
So 70% of women and 15% of men, after having intimate partner violence,
yeah,
feel afraid after, which is interesting.
Yeah.
So, like, the men feel like they can then defend themselves later on.
Huh.
And intimate partner violence is correlated with relationship satisfaction for women, but not men.
Wait, what? So if a man is in an abusive
relationship, overall, it does not correlate with overall satisfaction, but for women, it does.
Really? That's so interesting.
96% of federal prosecution for domestic violence was against men. And from 2003 to 2012, 76% of domestic violence was committed against women versus 24% was committed against men. And of course, you should take into account that men report less than women.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this should be taken with a grain of salt. As Nicole mentioned, this often stemmed from the, you know, the concept of masculinity and patriarchy, and that when masculinity is threatened by these changing gender roles that are happening in society, that men may lash out more, is some of the thoughts. And like I said, there are several studies that do show similar rates among men and women, and some speculate that while this might be true, maybe if you take into account that violent resistance that we talked about,
yeah,
and say, well, women are committing this as well, but of course that could be because they're defending themselves, but also vice versa is true. If a female is perpetrating something on a male, they might defend themselves. But because a man is generally stronger, a smaller act relatively would injure the female more.
Yeah.
So it's all I mean, and with all of this, is that we have some solid data out there, but it's, you can never be 100% definitive. And also, intimate partner violence against men is just generally less accepted by society. The acceptance of aggression by women against men versus the condemnation of men aggression against women is just so pervasive that it's hard. And women, even when they're perpetrators, are often viewed as victims. So it's really, really hard to suss this out. About 27% of women report it. And only about 10% of men do. So not that many women report it. It's like 1 in 4 women report it.
Yeah.
But 1 in 10 men report it. So it's much less. There's a few studies out of England and Wales was a big one that over a 12-month period, about 4.2% of men experience intimate partner violence. And over their lifetime, it's about 15% of men do experience intimate partner violence. So it's definitely not negligible.
Right.
And then when you think about causes of female perpetrated intimate partner violence, it's often, in the vast majority, is in the context of being victimized. So anger, self-defense, and retaliation are common motives. But things that happen on both sides of the X and Y chromosome. Poor anger management, personality disorders, including antisocial and borderline, pattern of dominating relationships, substance abuse, criminal history, depression, jealousy, things that might have happened to you as a child, stress, and the general attitude of approval of partner violence. Like in some societies, it's the man will keep their woman in line. Hopefully that's less of a thing now, but it definitely historically has been a large part. And the other important thing to think about with intimate partner violence is the involvement of firearms. It's one thing if you get mad and punch somebody in the face, they will generally recover from it. But if you pull out a 9mm and shoot them in the face,
they generally won't.
They generally won't.
Not that you should go around punching people in the face regardless.
No. But the ease of which firearms being available to people has changed over time. And the more easily available firearms are, the easier it is to kill somebody. So for decades, literally for 4 decades, there had been a decline in homicides associated with intimate partner violence. They associated this with fewer and later marriages, increases in divorce, women being able to escape relationships by going into shelters or seeking help. So there was a study that in 2014, there were 1,875 homicides by intimate partners. In 2017, that increased to 2,237. So in 3 years, it increased by almost 400. And it wasn't a very big denominator to start with. So it went from 1,875 to 2,237 in 3 years. And this was primarily driven by gun violence. So in 2017, and they've also shown that from that over time, the percentage of women killed by guns by a male partner has increased. And of course, this is less hunting rifles and it's more handguns that are doing this. Mm. And they've shown that laws to prevent mass shootings have actually reduced some firearm suicide rates in several states. And they think that it likely would also decrease rates of this too.
But they haven't looked at that yet.
But they haven't done the data for that yet. Mm. Under federal law, domestic abusers are prohibited from having firearms if they are the subject of domestic violence restraining order or if they've been convicted of certain crimes. But this is only for those who are or were spouses, mm-hmm. or who live together and share a child. Huh. So if you commit domestic violence on somebody else who is your spouse or you live with them and have a child with them, you will be prohibited from having a gun. This does not apply to dating partners necessarily.
Okay.
So this is what they call the boyfriend loophole, that if you are just dating, you might not have as strict restrictions put on you because the thought is you're not linked by the law.
Right.
Right? So it's harder to tie them in. So kind of BS. Last two things I wanted to say within this realm were the question is often asked, why don't you just leave? This is a big problem for women who are victims of abuse. And of course, there is a fear of retaliation, often a lack of alternative means of economic support. If you've been a quote-unquote stay-at-home mom and you don't have an independent source of income and you have three kids, how are you going to support them?
Yeah.
Concern for their children, lack of family support from friends and family, stigma and fear of losing the custody of your child associated with divorce. And the final one that was listed, and I'm going to read this out verbatim, love and the hope that the partner will change.
Yeah.
And then because I just talked about children associated with this, there is a huge effect on children that might not even be victims of this domestic violence, but may just be seeing domestic violence, which you can argue makes them a victim for sure. Some short-term effects, you can have this fear and anxiousness, reactionary changes, so like bedwetting, lack of participation, headaches and stomach aches, acting out, bullying, drugs and alcohol. There's a lot of short-term effects from this. And then the big long-term effect, besides health problems like mental health, diabetes, obesity, which is huge, is just repeating the cycle.
Yeah.
A boy that sees his mom abused is 10 times more likely to abuse a female partner. A girl who sees their mom abused is 6 times more likely to be sexually abused herself. It's huge and so scary. And I feel bad for anybody involved with this, but having your child also be affected is just incomprehensible. Just scary.
Yeah, the CDC lists a combination of individual, relational, community, and societal factors that lead to becoming a perpetrator. And they say that consistently one of the strongest predictors is being a victim of physical or psychological abuse, closely followed by witnessing IPV between parents as a child. So yeah, definitely bad situation that just perpetuates itself.
So sad. Yeah.
So as Jordan mentioned, there are a bunch of consequences besides death that can occur with intimate partner violence. So survivors can experience mental health problems, And are at high risk for engaging in health risk behaviors, such as smoking, binge drinking, and sexual risk behaviors. Also, we've talked a lot about the personal consequences of IPV, and those are completely devastating, but there are also costs to society.
Yes.
So there's a lifetime economic cost associated with medical services for intimate partner violence-related injuries, lost productivity from paid work and criminal justice and other costs, and that amounts to $3.6 trillion in the United States.
Per year?
I think per year.
Wow.
Yeah. I'd have to double check that, but yeah.
Stop it, people. Just stop.
So the cost of intimate partner violence over victims' lifetime, they've estimated to be a little bit over $100,000 for women and a little bit over $20,000 for men.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's... Imagine being able to put that towards your kid's college fund.
Yeah. I would only have double-digit thousands worth of debt. The other thing I found kind of interesting was traumatic brain injury.
Ooh, yeah. That is a very important thing.
Yeah. So apparently up to 90% of injuries sustained in IPV are to the head, face, and neck.
I can see that.
So 75% of women with a history of intimate partner violence sustained at least one partner-related traumatic brain injury, and nearly 50% have sustained repetitive traumatic brain injuries. And women who have experienced repetitive TBIs or traumatic brain injuries report symptoms that are consistent with like those of chronic traumatic encephalopathy. They have problems with concentration, memory, headaches, depression, anxiety, fatigue, and sleep. There's actually a researcher, and she has looked into TBIs in women who have suffered from intimate partner violence, and they have extrapolated that the number of women sustaining intimate partner violence-related TBIs dwarf the combined number of military and NFL TBIs or concussions reported.
Really?
Yeah, using annual estimates of severe physical violence, about 1,600,000 women are estimated to sustain repetitive IPV-related TBIs in comparison to 18,000 reported for the military and 281 reported by the NFL.
Wow.
And this researcher is Eve Valera. She's at Harvard. There haven't been that many studies looking at this. So it's like a very interesting question to know if like a CTE syndrome develops in women in these relationships who sustain repetitive TBIs. There have only been 2 studies published and both of them are Dr. Valera's. So definitely an area that needs more research.
Interesting.
A researcher at the Acquired Brain Injury Research Lab at the University of Toronto, Helena Haag, says that even if some of the estimates are overstated, as few as half of women who are exposed to IPV suffer traumatic brain injuries. And so that would still be 1 in every 8 women.
That's which is crazy.
The same statistic as breast cancer. Yes.
No.
But there's very little existing knowledge and research exploring this intersection. So definitely something that I want to keep an eye out for in the future when I'm doing readings.
Yeah.
So in terms of prevention, the biggest thing that we as a society can do is to support the development of healthy, respectful, and nonviolent relationships and communities. And the CDC actually has a pretty comprehensive guide of programs, practices, and policies, and a very cool infographic that kind of summarizes all of that.
Yes.
And we can post that to social media. I don't necessarily have to read through it, but I did want to highlight a couple of the tools that they have on their website because they were kind of interesting. They have this thing called Dating Matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, strategies to promote healthy teen relationships. So it's this evidence-based teen dating violence prevention model that was developed by the CDC, which has prevention strategies for individuals, peers, families, schools, and neighborhoods. And it focuses on teaching 11 to 14-year-olds healthy relationship skills before they start dating. Although maybe it's while they're dating. I don't know the kids these days.
Just like with the HPV shot, get it before you start.
Exactly.
Having sex.
And reducing behaviors that increase the risk for dating violence, like substance abuse and sexual risk-taking.
It's so smart. Just cut it off before it even starts.
Yeah, and I think it's, I mean, even if it's not about violence prevention, I don't know. I think it's important to learn how to be in a healthy relationship.
100%. Because many people have great models at home, but a lot of people do not have good models at home.
Yeah.
And it's really important to catch everybody.
Yep. I almost did the Dating Matters. They have like an educator module, so you can kind of learn how you talk to teens about it. And I almost did it just to see what it was like, but then I didn't have enough time.
That's fair.
I might go back and do it.
Do it.
Definitely would do it if I ever have kids. It's for people who interact with teens to take it. So they've got modules for like parents. They've got modules for educators. I don't know if they have modules for teens to help educate their peers. They have different modules for like training resources for teaching you how to talk to teens about being in a healthy relationship and recognize flags for when somebody might not be in one and like how to intervene.
I like it.
Yeah.
I wanted to briefly touch on some treatment. And a lot of this is because when you think of some type of intimate partner violence, you think of, well, if you report it, you can get the cops out there and they could arrest somebody. But the initial police response and arrest is often not enough to protect the victims. Even if you have a restraining order, it will only last so long, and sometimes you can't keep that going forever. So many states have mandated batterer intervention programs for men who have been charged with assault against an intimate partner. There's also quite a few different treatment regimens. I just wanted to point out a couple of them. One is called the Duluth model. It uses a psychoeducational approach, which uses this wheel that is called power and control wheel, and they use it to achieve behaviors that fall on the equality between having power and control and balance in your relationship, but not going overboard.
Huh.
And they try to re-educate men and replace some of these maladaptive behaviors. There's also cognitive behavioral therapy that is used in many things, and this is to modify faulty or problematic cognitions, beliefs, or emotions to prevent future violent behavior. This includes anger management, assertiveness, relaxation techniques. There's a lot that goes into this that we can have an entire podcast on, so
I can go to life. When you say relaxation techniques, all it makes me think about is somebody being like, relax, and like gently stroking your hair. Just relax.
I'm just thinking like in Zoolander when they try to like lull them in that movie and then it hypnotizes them later on and makes them do something in the background that they don't realize they're doing.
I mean, you could hypnotize them to just not do the thing. That would be very efficient.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
So we need to work on a hypnotizing scheme here.
Yes, exactly. Great. I mean, I'm in quarantine. I might as well learn a new skill.
I mean, I learned how to juggle, so you can learn how to hypnotize.
Exactly.
So these techniques really only reduce intimate partner violence by about 5% or so.
Oh, wonderful!
So it's not, they're not the most effective.
So good.
5% is better than nothing.
Yeah.
There's also other treatment, like conjoint treatment. And this one I thought was really good because 50% of couples with intimate partner violence have reciprocal violence. Whether that's violent resistance or something else, it's not always just one of the partners. And also many couples who experience intimate partner violence stay together. So they're going to have to work together to come to a solution. There's a stat that 37 to 58% of couples who seek regular outpatient treatment have experienced physical assault in the past year.
Whoa.
So about a third to a half of couples that are going to treatment have had a physical assault in the past year.
I guess they're one of the reasons they're in therapy.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this includes behavior, couples therapy, cognitive behavior approaches. There's a lot of other things, but kind of working with the couple to approach these problems together rather than putting it all on one partner, which I thought is smart.
Yeah.
And at this point, we do want to point out one fantastic resource that's out there is the National Domestic Violence Hotline, which is 1-800-799-SAFE or 7233. Again, 1-800-799-SAFE or 7233.
There's also a crisis text line. If you aren't able to use the telephone, you can text HOME, H-O-M-E, to 741741. So HOME to 741741 if you can't call. And since we are a forensic pathology podcast, we also wanted to touch base on the role of the medical examiner / coroner in these cases. So the biggest role that the medical examiner or coroner has is surveillance. There's a way that they collect all of the statistics re-homicide and intimate partner violence, and that is through the autopsy and investigation records of the medical examiner and coroner. And I found an example of a really great program that was developed in partnership with the Virginia Department of Public Health. It's called the Family and Intimate Partner Homicide Surveillance Project. And it was started in 1999 and utilizes news reports and records collected by the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner to identify cases of homicide that were due to family or intimate partner discord. And then they create annual and special reports and provide aggregate data to domestic violence stakeholders. And the data is used to create different policies and programs, create trainings for those who are intervening with victims and offenders, provides the public with an understanding of the risk factors surrounding family and intimate partner violence, and determines the need for specialized services in the community for helping victims of this type of violence. And since the project started in 1999, it's helped to establish 19 intimate partner homicide fatality review teams throughout Virginia. And we touched on these types of committees or teams in the sudden unexpected infant death episode. And we will have a more detailed episode about these types of teams and committees later. But yes. Suffice it to say that these teams go into the community and help to develop coordinated responses to whatever their niche topic is. So in this case, domestic violence. They've also created conference and training materials for a lot of different groups to educate them about family and intimate partner violence. I also found a bunch of global studies that used medical examiner or coroner data to come up with different epidemiological studies regarding not only the rates of intimate partner violence in different countries, but also the most common causes of death. So you mentioned firearm injury. So in Portugal, one of these types of studies found that 45.2% of women killed in intimate partner homicides were killed by gunshot wounds. So that was the most common. And 56.5% of women had non-fatal injuries, suggesting like long-standing abuse or like a fight directly before the homicide occurred.
Earlier trauma.
Yeah. In South Africa, they used such a study to show that although the number of female homicides was lower in 2009 than 1999, the rates weren't actually different. So it kind of emphasized the point that that country needs to focus greater efforts to implement some sort of evidence-based violence prevention. And then this one in Canada, I thought was kind of interesting. They identified different risk factor combinations for cases of domestic homicide. And they actually found that stabbing was the most common cause of death in just over a third of the cases, 34%, and then followed by shooting. Although this might have to do with the fact that Canada has
better gun laws.
Yeah.
Better gun control laws in the US.
Yeah. So in Canada, stabbing was the most common, followed by shooting, then strangulation, and then beating. And then in a little bit more than a third of cases, the perpetrator also immediately committed suicide after or soon after. They found that the most significant risk factors for homicide due to intimate partner violence were that there was a history of domestic violence, which makes sense, and then that there was actual or pending separation.
Gotcha.
So okay. If they let on that they were going to leave their partner, then that would precipitate the fatal event.
Part of the controlling aspect of intimate partner violence.
Right, yeah.
And then the kind of the other biggest role of the medical examiner coroner is to decide, was this in fact homicide, suicide, etc. So you can have a case where you have somebody that has, let's say, a slash across their neck, and you need to be able to decide from the wound patterns, from the story, all that other stuff, was this caused by somebody else or was this caused by themselves? There was one interesting case that I found, and this isn't my story, in France of a couple. It was a male was 32, woman was 29. They were jobless. They had a family. the kids were somewhere else, and they found both of them dead in their apartment together. And this goes into detailing all of the wounds and everything that they've seen, but they determine that essentially both of these people killed each other.
What?
Because they both had mortal stab wounds. One was stabbed in the heart, the other was stabbed in the back that I think got the aorta, like from the back.
Ooh.
Really impressive. But they also both had defensive wounds. So I think this is a really good example of, we really do have to take the entire thing into account. And all of the work that we do on identifying different types of wounds and patterns of injury, short-term and long-term, our job is to come up with that final manner and cause of death. And then, you know, you can take all that amazing data and analyze it and come up with all the things that Nicole just talked about.
Yeah.
But our first job is to write that death certificate and to make it so people can use these vital statistics and extrapolate that data. So step one is...
do your job.
is doing our job. And it's such an important part for all of what we just talked about. I mean, this entire episode has been on... a good chunk of it is data that medical examiners and coroners provide to the world at large. So it's really important.
Yeah.
I know we've had a few episodes where we haven't done our stories, but we're going to go back to that pattern again today.
Yeah.
Unintended.
So my story is about Amy Homan McGee. A lot of the stuff that Jordan touched on when she was talking about why people don't leave, and even if they do leave or have a restraining order, why that doesn't always work, come up in this story.
Yeah, same with mine.
Yeah. So
it's a pattern for a reason.
Yeah. So Amy Homan met Vincent McGee in 1997 in State College, Pennsylvania, which when I was reading this story, I definitely thought she was at State College in Pennsylvania.
Oh, no, but it's a town.
Yeah. So, interesting name. I would love to know the story about that. And she worked in a home store, and he drove the armored truck that picked up money from the shop. So, he started, you know, chatting her up, and they started a relationship. And pretty soon, Vincent started driving her to work, picking her up every day, calling the store incessantly, checking her schedule to make sure she wasn't working alone with men. You know,
this kind of sounds like stalking
in a relationship. Not. And around the time that they started dating, Amy also started to have bruises that she said came from softballs and falling boxes whenever
obviously
she was asked about them. So they eventually ended up getting married and having children. But Amy's coworkers continued to notice that he had this obsessive behavior. And sometimes they would go so far as to draft fake schedules to throw him off track when she had to be working with male coworkers. And Amy's parents even drove her to the police station at one point to get a protection order. And one person said of Vincent, he always carried a gun and he was almost always drunk. He was like a bomb rolling around.
Sounds about right.
So in late December 1998... Amy called the police when Vincent broke down a door and threatened to kill her. However, 9 days after the incident, Amy did not renew the protection from abuse order, and Vincent wrote to the county judge asking for a return of his stash of weapons. You mentioned that if you're married and you are you have this protection order in place, then they take away your weapons. So since the order expired, he wrote to the judge, said, can I get my handguns and knife back? And they were like, yeah, sure, I guess. And in the letter he wrote, I have been given the opportunity to make peace with myself and my wife, and I have every intention of doing so. I do not plan to ever be in this position again. But of course, since you know that I'm telling a story on a forensics podcast, that was
something bad happened, didn't it, Nicole?
Yeah, there are no happy stories here.
Yeah, unfortunately.
So on November 8th, 2001, Vincent visited Amy at work and they had a pretty bad argument.
Okay.
And then Amy went out with her mother and her children to a restaurant. And while they were out, Amy asked her mom if she could stay with her. So They drove back to the McGee residence, and while her mom and children stayed in the car, I also saw some reports that her dad was in the car at this as well, but the main articles that I was reading, it was just her mom and her children. So while her mom and her children were in the car, Amy went inside to pack, and they thought that Vincent wasn't going to be home, slash Diana, Amy's mom, offered to call the police, but Amy said that no, because she thought that if Vincent was there, it would just incite him to even more rage.
Gotcha.
About 5 minutes after Amy had gone inside, Vincent exited the house and motioned for Diana, Amy's mom, to come to the door. "Why?" she asked. "I shot Amy," he answered. So Diana called 911, and when the police arrived, they found Vincent standing over Amy's body. She was already dead from a bullet wound to the head.
Okay.
And his blood alcohol level was 0.17.
That's stupidly high.
Yeah, so a little over twice the legal limit for driving. So Vincent waived his Miranda rights and agreed to make a statement, and he told police about the argument he had had with his wife earlier in the day.
Okay.
And then he said that he had two large glasses of vodka and Coke to cope.
What does large mean?
No idea.
Like an entire fifth of vodka with each one?
I mean, 0.17, and he was a regular alcoholic, so who knows?
Wow.
So he told police that when his wife came in later, he was watching TV and she walked past him. And he said that he was sitting in a chair and the handgun he always carries was placed in an uncomfortable position. So he was moving it from one side of his waistband to the other.
Obviously.
And it went off.
Yeah, it's always the story.
So he claimed he was so shocked that he dropped the gun. And then he noticed that his wife was lying on the floor, not moving. And he thought she was playing a joke.
Lies. Lies.
So the police dug into his record a little bit more, and it turns out he'd been arrested years earlier after he shot out a window of the family vehicle as he and his wife drove through Bedford County in 1999. And at that time, guess what? He claimed he'd accidentally discharged the handgun when he switched it from the left to the right side of his waistband.
Oh, good. Yep. Repetitive liars.
Yes.
Even better.
So, turns out this was a favorite excuse of his was, oh no, it accidentally discharged.
When I was moving it from one side of my waist to the other.
Yeah, exactly. So, he was charged with first degree murder, and his attorney argued that he was likely suffering from an alcoholic blackout and didn't know what he did. And at most, she said that he deserved a conviction for involuntary manslaughter, a count for which he would serve no jail time. Because it was Vincent's intent that day to drink, not to kill.
Ugh. Please tell me he didn't get away with that.
Luckily, the jurors did not buy that. And he was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison without parole.
Good.
And because on so many podcasts we hear about people getting out early.
Yeah.
I looked him up, because you can actually just like look up prisoners' names and see where they are. And he is still in jail.
Good.
And they had this photo of him.
Oh, that's creepy.
So I just wanted to show you that to see what your reaction was.
That's cute. I have a lot of thoughts, but I'm not going to say them out loud while I'm being recorded.
Nice, good. So Detective Deirdre Fischel later made a documentary called Telling Amy's Story about Amy's experience. She turned it into a very cohesive timeline that clearly showed the danger signs in Amy's relationship and the number of times that police or other services could have intervened. Although, as we all know, hindsight is 20/20, but the documentary serves as a really good training tool for police and members of the community to kind of recognize danger signs and see ways in which they could help. And unfortunately, the documentary isn't available to stream anywhere, but I was able to watch a 15-minute overview available on YouTube, and I'll definitely post the link to our website. But
cool.
It's a very sad story, but silver lining, some good has come of it from this documentary and helping good. To make people more aware of this issue and ways in which they can help.
Yeah. The no happy stories here, Linus.
That should be our first t-shirt.
That's going to be the story of our book.
There are no happy stories. I hope we have happy stories. Oh, no.
Not personally, but with work.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's going to be for a workbook, not a personal book.
Okay, like our textbook on forensic pathology. Yeah, exactly. There are no happy stories.
Yeah.
I like it.
Done.
When are we ready?
Deadmen Do Tell Tales. There are no happy stories here.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so excited.
Done. All right, so now for my not happy story. I am going to list the name of the perpetrator rather than the name of the victim, and you will see why. So my story is about Sean Windsor, who was born in November of 1963. In the early 1980s, so when he was in his late teens, early 20s, Sean married Angela, who was 15 at the time.
Oof. Nope.
Family disapproved of the union.
I wonder
Surprise.
Why.
Sean had encouraged her to leave home, but they had little to no money, and they sometimes had to sleep by the railroad tracks or stay with friends or, you know, all the other great things with the teen marriages and all that other stuff.
Yep.
Eventually, they had two sons and one daughter, and at this point, there was no abuse happening. But soon when he was drinking, Sean would yell at Angela, would call her names, would push her. It escalated to smacking, and eventually he started getting to the point that he would assault her with her with his fists. So this became worse and worse, and it led to this incident where Sean asked Angela to hold a lawnmower steady, but it was really heavy, and seems like she was a tiny woman, and so she fell backwards from the weight, and then he got so mad that he hit her with a wrench.
What?
And she wasn't able to walk for days. This escalated even more as Sean began to abuse their two sons. Once so badly that one of the sons couldn't move and tried to make him sit cross-legged on the floor. And then if Angela would try to interrupt, he would turn on Angela and then hit her with a nylon dog leash. So he would threaten her if she ever tried to leave. So this is kind of the normal escalating thing of starts out kind of okay. We start to get into some verbal issues. I'm going to say minorly violent attacks. Into more violent attacks. Now the kids are involved. Ugh. Try to protect the kids, but it makes it worse for you.
Yeah.
You try to leave, but you get threatened.
Yeah.
All the quote-unquote normal progression of intimate partner violence. Then in 1990, so this is about 10-ish years after they got together, at this point, Angela's 15-year-old cousin Betty was having trouble with school. And Angela and Sean lived in a better school district. So Betty came to live with Sean and Angela.
No! No!
So Sean and Betty became romantically involved.
No!
AKA rape, because she's 15 and he's 20, at least 27.
Ugh.
And a few months later, she got pregnant.
Ugh.
So the only silver lining that I've been able to find in this story is at this point, Angela uses opportunity, divorced, and moved away with the kids.
But she left Betty there.
But she left Betty there, who is now pregnant. Who is her, left Betty there, who's her cousin with Sean, who she knows has already abused her. So Sean and Betty, the quote from the website was, tied the knot in the middle of a bread aisle. And I wasn't sure if that was an innuendo, if that was some weird, like, quickie something. But not too surprisingly, this abuse started up pretty soon.
Yeah.
At one point, Sean had bought a manual car and was trying to teach Betty how to drive a manual, but he got so annoyed that he hit her in the face with their 8-year-old kid in the backseat. So this was about 8 years into this, because she was pregnant kind of at the beginning. So Betty actually pressed charges, and Sean was found guilty of domestic violence and assault, and he had to stay 500 feet away from the family.
Nice. Oh, good for Betty.
Good for Betty. Oh. But remember, there are no happy stories
here.
No.
No.
So Betty...
You gave me a little bit of hope. You can't just give the hope.
I gotta take it away. Rip it out from underneath your feet.
Ouch.
So Betty filed for divorce. But Sean refused to go to court, and in December of 2003, Betty and their son, Corey, were at Betty's mom's house, spending the holidays. A few days after Christmas, December 28th, Sean apparently called asking to see Corey, and because Betty felt guilty keeping his son away during the holidays, agreed to let him come and see Corey, their son. Once Sean got in the house, he stabbed Corey in the heart. and then beat Betty and Corey to death with a barbell. Sean left a detailed written confession, covered in blood, and disappeared. This was in December of 2003.
Wait, was the mom there?
The mom was out at this time, I think, because there was no mention of her in this.
Wow.
So, he appeared on America's Most Wanted twice. And viewers apparently provided the police with tips. And then in July of 2004, they found him in Shelby, North Carolina, 9 months later.
Wow.
After he murdered his wife and child in cold blood. He was convicted of murder, and he's currently sitting on death row in the Kentucky State Penitentiary.
Well, I'm glad he is also still in prison.
I think that this story is one of those things that summarizes a lot of what we've talked about.
Yeah.
Kind of the escalating violence, finding a way to escape, trying to escape, but even with the court putting these things into effect, having these policies, having these, it doesn't always do the thing that it's supposed to do.
Yeah.
And in this case, it was a knife and a barbell. But if he had a gun, it would have been that much easier. And these people managed to find a way back. I don't know what happened to Sean when he was a child, but it's never an excuse for this.
Right.
And of course, the other thing that I worry about are Angela's sons, right? Because they were actively abused by their father.
Yeah.
And Angela and her sons and daughter were able to escape. But who knows what those long-term effects are going to be, let alone the TBI from being hit upside the head with a wrench.
Right.
Like, there's the short-term effects, but there's also these long-term and the generational effects that happen from these stories. And luckily, both of these people are currently sitting in prison somewhere and not able to harm people. But it's way too easy for people to get back into the cycle of abuse very quickly if and when they're let out.
Yeah.
It's scary.
Yeah, one of the things I didn't mention was, in that Portugal study, they found that 57.9% of the women in the study that were killed by former partners, the majority of them were killed during the first year after the relationships end.
Okay.
So it's a pretty vulnerable period of time.
Definitely.
Oh my gosh. What a bummer episode.
Sorry, guys. I'm trying to think of a happy thing to throw in here.
But there are no happy stories here. So
we'll jump off of that into Sochmeeds, I guess.
I guess. If you liked this and any of our other episodes, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast. It's how other people find out about us and we get boosted up on the various podcasting platforms.
You can visit our website at deadmendotellpodcast.com, where we link to all of our sources and our episode guide.
On Twitter, we're at Dead Men Do.
On Insta, we're at The Dead Tale Tales.
And our Facebook page is Dead Men Do Tell Tales Podcast.
And of course, you can always send us an email if you have questions, comments, anything to thedeadtaletales@gmail.com or directly through the website.
And our opening music is Introducing the Pre-Roll by Lee Rosevere, who you can find on SoundCloud. And we promise we're going to try to do a happier topic next time.
Yeah, let's do something with a little bit, at least less sad.
Yes.
But, you know, reach out to friends and family if you see somebody that's injured in a way that you don't expect. Even if, say, you know they play rugby, but they show up with a black eye, check on your friends and family and make sure that they're doing okay and ask those questions. Nobody's ever going to be mad if you're like, hey, I see you have this bruise. Like, oh no, I actually play rugby and I actually got elbowed in the eye. Which has happened to me. Like, I am more okay saying that, knowing that somebody is concerned.
Yes.
Than vice versa.
Better to show concern.
Yeah. So yeah, there's a few great resources out there. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is fantastic. Again, that's for calling. It's 1-800-799-SAFE, which is 7233, which also has an online chat option.
And if you feel safer texting, you can text the crisis text line. So text HOME to 741-741.
And stay safe out there, guys. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
I don't think there was a good way to end that.
There was not. Should have thought about that.
Yeah.